Yep, that would be a rhino, and we'll get to that in a moment. Josh Hoy is first up today, a fifth-generation rancher steeped in cowboy, living and loving the prairie from his Flying W Ranch in Kansas. Lance Irving is involved with the Sand County Foundation, and Ed Warner is a serial philanthropist and self-proclaimed radical conservationist. One of his projects was working with black rhinos in Zimbabwe. I'm Robin with Cultivated Audio for September 2021. Boy, back in the day when you got started, you probably never felt like you'd be doing interviews and being a spokesperson.
No, it definitely was a lot lonelier back then.
Oh. Josh, let's begin with you telling us some basics about your Flying W Ranch, where it is, what the land is like, rainfall, that sort of thing.
Sure. We are located in the eastern part of Kansas, the Flint Hills. It's the last 2-4% of tall grass prairie left on the planet is here in the Flint Hills. The only reason it's still here is because of the limestone and flint rock that kept them from plowing it up back in the day. So we've managed to keep virgin tall grass prairie here on a big scale. I don't think there's any place else in the world like that now. We get about 35 inches of rain a year on average. And as far as Flying W, I'm a fifth generation rancher. My daughter's six. My family started ranching in Flint Hills back in 1877. But my cousin and I partnered up on the Flying W Ranch in 1996. He was a young man like me, just a year older than me, but had recently sold a family business he and his brothers had and wanted to start a ranch with me. So we partnered up, and he had the equity and I had the sweat. So it worked out well.
Yes, certainly sounds like it. Now, you spent many years cowboying around the West, and I'd imagine that certainly gave you not only some of your ability to sweat, but some great insights into working with nature's literally time-tested system. What were a few of your first steps when you started ranching at the Flying W, and did it start out as 7,000 acres? I'm naive about this, of course, but that's a huge piece of property there.
You bet. I cowboyed in 14 different states around the country, and I'll tell you, that was the best education I could have had, I think. One of the things that really stood out by traveling around and seeing different parts of the world was just how wonderful a native prairie is to ranch on. It's so much better than places that have been farmed and then planted back, and so much easier to manage than the really dry, brittle country out west. So that was a big benefit to me. Also, I was doing that back in the late 80s and 90s, and boy, that was a big time of transition. A lot of ranches were changing hands generationally, and most of them were selling and dissolving, getting broken up. So I got to work on literally hundreds of ranches that just don't even exist anymore. But one of the things I noticed was that the ranches that were staying together or growing and thriving were a lot different than the normal run-of-the-mill ranch. They were holistically managed, most of them. At least were using a lot of the principles of like Stan Parsons and some of those early pioneers in holistic management. A big influence in those early days, a neighbor up in the Flint Hills area, a neighbor, he's, 60, 70 miles away, but Pete Farrell, who was, a very early adopter of cell grazing and kind of holistic approach to management, hired me a lot for day work. And that was one of the things I noticed, that the guys that were able to hire help were doing things differently.
Right,
so,
yes.
I figured out quickly that was a good plan. When I partnered up with my cousin Warren, I went to Pete for advice, and he said immediately, go to ranching for profit, educate yourself, figure out what you need to do. And of course, that was great advice. I was very fortunate. I started without all the bad habits and bad traditions that a lot of ranches do. So I was able to just eliminate a lot of the things that could have really drawn me down and start off doing things that were sustainable and economically viable and fun.
Yes, yes. Well, I'm sure you had a lot of fun taking down all those fences, right?
Yeah, that took a long time. That was a 20-year project until we got to where we felt we could do that and still maintain our carrying capacity and it keep improving our prairie. But boy, it's a wonderful feeling to be there now.
Absolutely, yes. Tell us about how many cattle you have, and you have cattle and bison, sure. I believe. Is that true?
We don't have bison anymore. We have a neighbor that we used to partner on with the bison herd, but we got out of that, and we just have cattle and horses. We're hoping to add sheep this year, too.
So what kind of breed do you have, and what are some of your grazing practices?
We do a lot of custom grazing, so we take in cattle for other people, and those are just conventional cattle. We take in a lot of yearlings for just a 90-day short grazing season from mid-April to mid-July. And that works really well here in the tallgrass because that's when our major growth is. That's where almost all of our really high-quality feed comes in those 90 days. We can move them around a lot, and the grass just really thrives, and then we ship them off, and they're somebody else's problem.
Yeah, and it's like a double dip, isn't it? Because you're having them bring their cattle, and I'm sure there's a fee to that, and yet they're actually helping by eating down and then regrowing. Wonderful.
Yeah. Big reason for that is we don't have to take any risk. Because, you know, the cattle market can be so volatile and damaging if it's going down or up or up and down, as it has been the last few years. By letting other people own them and take that risk, we can still make money by grazing and then use the cattle and grazing as a tool to improve the prairie. So it works well. But and we also have cows that we keep year-round for another farmer and custom graze them. But then we also own a herd of cows of our own. And we've been breeding them for about 20 years. They started off as a Corianti Longhorn herd, and we've just bred grass genetics into them over the years. And we now have some nice, tiny little cows that are super thrifty and almost zero inputs to bring us nice, fat, little grass-fed calves.
Wonderful. And speaking of those calves, you do your calving schedule in May, which to me, being an outsider, seems like so much common sense. And yet the majority of people do it in January or February. Isn't that true?
Oh, it still makes my neighbors very angry to see me calving in May. They just don't think it's right. When I see them calving in February and January, I don't think that's right. So, yeah, when they're all out suffering and groaning and having cattle die, I'm sitting in by the fire. It's a pretty good trade-off.
But,
that was something I learned early on just from helping people calve all over the country. The guys that were doing it in sync with nature within 60 days of the summer solstice or equinox there were so much better. You know, the cattle were happier, the people were happier, and it was a whole lot more economically viable. And so that just was never even a question for me. I knew that's when we would be calving on green grass.
Right. Now, are there any drawbacks to that?
Not really. You know, the main thing people think is then you don't have cattle ready for that October market when you're supposed to sell calves, but that's often the worst time of year to sell calves. We wean usually in December, January, depending on the year, and then sell into the spring market when grass is greening up and people are looking for light calves to go to grass with.
Right.
So it's a good timing for us, but a lot of people's objection is that you don't have those great big calves to wean in the fall like they're used to having, but we don't need to have that.
And rest is certainly key for the land as well as livestock. Before we talk about your conservation with the land and your methods for doing that, tell us about how you keep your livestock stress-free as much as possible.
You bet. One part of our management system is what we call the chaos factor. We try not to get locked into practices that, you know, have to kind of be rigid and stay. We want to be as flexible as possible so we can pivot according to weather and markets and health problems, anything like that. We can just always move and flex and change because that's what nature does. You know, nature seldom has hard lines. Most things are squiggly and
barriers.
And so that's what we try to mimic, is to have squiggly soft barriers on things so we can be flexible and move and maneuver to adjust. And that goes right into our stockmanship, too. We try to do things as low stress as possible for our cattle and horses and us. You know, it took us a while to learn that lesson. For 20 years here, we ran a guest ranch as well as our cattle ranch. It was a wonderful business. We met wonderful people. We made lifelong friends from it. And one of the most important parts of it, we felt we really were helping to educate the public about regenerative agriculture. But it did just chew through all of our spare time. And we found that the ranching part of our lives was our break and our ease and our kind of vacation from the guest ranching. But it still was hard work. You know, we enjoyed it.
Sure.
And it was more relaxing, but it was still hard work. And when COVID hit, we, of course, shut down the guest ranch because we needed to. And we were talking about opening back up, and we just realized, no, we're not going to open back up. We're going to retire from that.
Right.
And we're, you know, still going to do some things with guests where we have people come out for seed collection days or bird surveys, things like that, and maybe some customer appreciation days for beef customers to come out and enjoy the ranch on some level, but not the full-scale lodging, horseback riding, and cattle drives that we used to do.
Let's talk a little bit now about the actual conservation of the prairie, and the grasses and native forbs go hand in hand, of course. What are some keys, perhaps, to maintaining nature's lead here?
I always say my main job for managing the tallgrass prairie here is to just stay out of the way. It's such a good system. You know, we have to make some decisions that are going to impact the environment, but we always try to make sure we make the least impactful decisions. So if we're grazing, we want to graze in a way that's going to be the most beneficial for the grass, for the prairie, and the least harmful or altering, at least. The same with any kind of management, like control of brushy and woody plants that are coming in, invasive weeds, anything like that. We try to figure out a way to do it, you know, obviously without chemicals, but also with as little mechanical and physical removal as possible, too. So we use fire, grazing, and rest as our main tools.
You just mentioned the squiggly, which I appreciate you getting very technical there with me, but do you have a certain general amount of time that a land will rest after a good grazing and or a fire burn? And maybe you could tell us a little bit about that. That's something that not a lot of people know about, I don't believe.
You bet. And this part of the country is a lot different than, you know, out west where it's a much more brittle environment. The amount of rest of prairie needs really depends on rainfall and time and even temperature.
Right.
But, you know, we have much briefer resting periods here than other areas. The way our ranch is set up, we have two great big pastures. One's 1,200 acres and one's about 2,000 acres. And then we have another 1,000 acres or so kind of in the middle that's along the Coin Creek, which cuts through our property kind of right through the middle of it. And those are broken into about 20 little traps. And so that's grazed more like a conventional cell grazing system. But we use that as management for the two big pastures, too, so we can pull cattle into those, one of the smaller places, and hold them if we're needing to rest a certain area. But most of the time we use IMG, which is instinctive migratory grazing, which is a term that Bob Kinford coined, but something we've been attempting to get going for the last 20-some years. And with his help these last few years, we've really fine-tuned it and got right where we want to be with it, or awful close to it. We influence the cattle to stay tight, travel, and graze where we want them to, and not graze where we don't want them to. And it certainly isn't as perfect of a system as polywire and neat little pie wedges and cells, but boy, it's a much more liberating system for us and the cattle. They're less stressed, we're less stressed.
Wonderful.
And I don't have to build polywire fence, which I'm allergic to.
Like any good rancher, right?
Yeah. But it's been wonderful. We started off in our smaller pastures trying to do that, and it worked. You can use IMG principles and management in smaller pastures, but boy, it works so much better on a bigger scale where they have kind of a landscape scale pasture where they can travel on grazing paths for a day or two at a time and just move more like a migratory herd and less like a captive herd.
Yes, and of course nothing is set in stone, as you said, but what kind of time periods do you have? 7,000 acres is quite a bit of land. How long a period do you go between seeing certain sections of your ranch, or how regular is it that you do see all the different sections?
Our headquarters is about 4,000 acres, and then the original Hoy home place is about 20 miles south of our headquarters. My dad owns that, but we lease it from him. We're on the headquarters every day, and we cover, you know, most of that. a couple times a week. My dad's place, the Flying H Ranch, we come down to at least twice a week and take care of the cattle that are down here and maintain the property. And then part of the property is a leased country, and we only see that during the 90-day grazing season between like April 15th and July 15th most of the time. That's when we spend most of our time there. But we cover our ground a lot, partly because we love to. And I'll tell you, when we were running the guest ranch, we didn't cover it as well as we should. That was one of the reasons we decided to shut down. We realized we'd really kind of been letting the ranching suffer, and that was a strong incentive for us to retire from that and spend more time doing what we really love.
Yes. Now, you mentioned the water that runs through your property, and those riparian areas or the land adjacent to the streams or pond. Is there anything you look for in that area in particular where there's water that might be a sign of, oh, something needs to happen here? Or
So, you know, of course, riparian areas are the most fragile and vulnerable areas just by their nature because of the runoff, because of the tendency for modern cattle to loaf there. One of the things we've found is like our cows, which are kind of close to feral cattle in some ways, spend almost no time loafing in riparian areas. They want to go get a drink, and then they want to go up to a height and ruminate, and then they'll get back up and graze on a grazing path somewhere. But the more domesticated cattle that we take care of for other people, we have to work more to get them to not want to loaf in ponds or riparian areas. But it works. We can get them to where they really just don't want to be down there. They want to be up and behaving more like a migratory herd. If you're a migratory herd and you're loafing around the water hole on the savannah of Africa, you're probably going to get eaten by lions a lot more.
Right. it's so that's in their DNA somewhere, right?
Yeah, it is. It is. That's in there. If you just kind of reboot it and get them thinking that way again, boy, they make better decisions.
Right. Do you delight in seeing any particular bird species for any special significance it might have, the fact that they're showing up?
You bet. That's one of our favorite things, is to just kind of catalog all the plant species and bird species and every other form of wildlife we run across as we ride and take care of our place. One of our favorites is Henslow sparrows, which you seldom see, but we hear them with their little chirping burp, that the sound that they make, so we know they're out there. And, you know, prairie chickens, greater prairie chickens we have here, and they're getting rarer and rarer, but we still have a good, healthy population. And we get to see them booming on their leks in the spring and doing their courtship dance, which is awfully exciting to watch.
That sounds so great.
And listen to.
Yes. Tell us about your horse. Obviously, you're on horseback going all over, I would imagine. Do you have one horse? Do you have many that you use to do this?
And we have many. When we had the guest ranch, we had 70 head of horses because we had to have a lot in order to keep people mounted. But now we have about 25. All of us have about 4 or 5 apiece that are kind of in our riding and working strings. And then we all have young horses that are coming on that we're training and getting ready to move into our riding strings. And we have some that are that love certain jobs and some that are really good at certain jobs. Depending on what we think we're going to be doing that day, we pick our mounts accordingly.
Well said.
And, yeah. Sometimes we mismatch what we end up actually doing and what horse we pick. But most of the time we're able to pick them for what they love.
Yeah.
And they absolutely love the IMG, kind of stockmanship. It's a lot less aggressive, a lot less predatory. The horses figure it out, and pretty soon they start using the posture and the movement and are able to just kind of communicate with the cattle pretty quickly. And even our dogs start mimicking the postures and the movement that we do. Okay. My wife's dog, Runt, is a little fat old cow dog at this point, but she's figured it out, and she just absolutely loves it. She goes right along with Gwen and communicates with the cows. It's pretty fun.
Is there a part of your ranching story that you don't get asked about much that you'd like to share more about?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. Let me think about that. I guess one of the things that's really important to us is the cowboy culture aspect of ranching, in particular our ranching. I got this wonderful opportunity to help a bunch of old timers back in the 80s and 90s, and they still had direct contact to the pre-industrial agriculture. My grandfather drove cattle from Texas to Kansas as a kid during World War One, when they, you know, rationing, they'd quit hauling cattle on trains for a while, and they started driving them again there. He drove cattle back and forth. He grew up loose herding cattle before they'd fenced the Flint Hills, and there were no pastures, big open range. And so I grew up learning from him, and then I went on to work for a lot of old timers that had come up in those eras when they didn't have industrial machinery and equipment to carry out the work of ranching. They had to do it all with stockmanship and horsemanship. And boy, is that a different world than we have today.
Yes.
You know, so many people today are more influenced by Hollywood movies and rodeo than they are by actual husbandry and stockmanship.
Absolutely.
And I think that's been really damaging to our industry. And nothing against land-grant colleges, but they went off to school and they learned that it was embarrassing to be a hillbilly that does things horseback and backwards, and you needed to buy equipment and chemicals and come into the modern era. And some of that is true. You know, you do need to use technology and improve things. But I think we lost a lot when people kind of let go and forgot about the heritage of actual stockmanship and husbandry. That's something I push a lot, is to get people back to the basics of stockmanship and really fine-tune it.
You can't blame Hollywood, in a sense, for taking off with the old stories.
Yeah, and the saying that really drives that, both for Hollywood and rodeo, those are the exciting things to show. Roping and cutting and riding broncs and doing all those things, that's exciting and it's fun to watch, but it's the thing you try to avoid every day out here. You know, you don't want to have to rope something. You don't want to have your horse misbehave and buck, or you don't want to have to cut really fast and quickly on cattle, because that's stressful.
Exactly.
And so, you know, good stockmanship, you avoid everything that
Absolutely.
Is glorified in Hollywood and rodeo.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Do you have a favorite yep. part of your day on the ranch?
It is anything horseback. Mm. Saddling up and getting on and going is just the best part. Mm. It is. Even better than that is when we get to just sit and watch our cows graze and watch what they're eating, watch what they're doing, watch their behaviors. The more time we spend watching our cows unobtrusively, we don't want to be influencing
right.
them at that point. We just want to observe them. The more we learn, I mean, my gosh, the things they eat at different times of the year, their behaviors. We started keeping our bulls on almost year-round. We pull them right the day before we drop our first calf in May, and then we hold them separate from the cows until mid-July so they calve when we want to. The rest of the year, we leave our bulls there, and we found that they travel and graze and maneuver in family pods. Mm. So we have drastically different colored and types of bulls in our herd, and their calves will be clumped and gathered around them. So like our Charlet bull will have all the Charlet offspring kind of clumped around him when he's laying out ruminating. Our Tarentaise bulls will have the Tarentaise calves around them. It's just fascinating to see that.
Sure.
And that kind of gets lost in more homogenous herds of, you know, all black Angus cows and calves that you hardly can tell the difference between them. But also the bulls are on for 60 days and then they're gone and they behave differently. But we find when we do turn our bulls in every year, the same cows go to them immediately and start grooming them and interacting with them.
Mm.
It's just really interesting to see how that works.
Yes. So it's certainly a family ranch in every direction.
Sure. Us and the cattle.
Yes. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Do you see any particular ranching practice that you're happy to see becoming the new normal, or that you would like to see become a new normal?
I'll tell you, you know, 20-some years ago, it felt really lonely. It felt pretty isolated. Quite frankly, a lot of our neighbors were very skeptical and scornful and even antagonistic about some of the things we were doing, because they're weird and different and off-putting. And we'd stayed pretty isolated in some ways, just because we hadn't done much reaching out or exploring to find other people doing what we were doing. And as my daughter became a teenager, I realized just how isolating that was for her professionally, as she developed her, you know, ranching profession credentials here. And so we really started kind of reaching out and exploring and finding people. And my gosh, we just found a wealth of young people that are either in ranching or getting into ranching that want to do it regeneratively and and are figuring out how to do it sustainably. And that's just been wonderful these last few years to kind of see that and cultivate friendships and relationships with people that are coming into this profession and doing it the way I want to see it done and I think the healthy way. And we're starting to see more and more people moving their calving later in the year. And, you know, last year we had a horrible cold spell in February and a whole bunch of people got on social media and were complaining and humble bragging about how brave and tough they were to be out there doing that. And it was awfully frustrating just to
sit back while you were by your fire.
And say, hey, just don't turn your bulls out till later. But I didn't. I refrained. But boy, it's hard to keep quiet on things like that. So I'd love to see people shift their calving because it's just cruel to drop a calf out of a 102-degree womb sopping wet into negative 20.
Oh, my gosh.
20 mile an hour wind.
Definitely.
Yeah, I'd love to see that just for the animal welfare aspect of things, if nothing else.
And lastly, Josh, rumor has it you are a chef. So what's your favorite steak and how do you prepare it?
Oh, my gosh. Ribeye, hands down. Absolutely love it. And just sea salt and on a grill is the best way. Low and slow and steady is the way I like to cook a steak. You know, one thing we've found, we don't butcher anything for our own consumption, most of our customers, until they're at least 3 or 4 years old. And for our beef, what we consume are 20-plus-year-old cows and find it to be so much better. It's so much more flavor and delicious. It's not like a steakhouse or a grocery store steak, not nearly as tender and stuff, but boy, the flavor is just so much better.
All right. What did I miss?
I guess one thing I'd like to say is, you know, we won the Leopold Award last year, and we went to the Sand County Foundation's Leopold Conference out in Steamboat Springs this August and got to meet like 130-some other Leopold winners. And spent 5 days at a conference there, and oh my gosh, wasn't that amazing and stimulating. The information we got, the conversations we had, it was so exciting to be around that many people that are doing exciting, sustainable agriculture. It's really fun.
Lance, tell us about the vision and work of Aldo Leopold that inspired the Sand County Foundation.
Sure. So Aldo Leopold talked about something that he termed a land ethic. And that's that connection to the land, to the biotic community and all of the animals and the birds, and being able to treat the land with respect and in an ethical way, knowing that humans are part of the ecosystem and we are not separate from it. How do we work with the land to achieve far more benefit than just growing food and fiber? How do we create additional habitat and restore our natural resources?
Yes, and that kind of links in to what I was speaking about with Ed Warner in how they would work with people in Africa. The best way to get them saving the land was to show them why it benefits them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I have the honor and privilege of talking with farmers, ranchers, and foresters all throughout the country. And I have never met one that wants to do harm by the land. One of the overarching goals of folks that work on the land is to make the land better for the next generation. There's challenges in getting there, but ultimately, most farmers, ranchers, and foresters want to leave their legacy as having improved the land. And helping people do that is a wonderful way to take care of our next generation.
Absolutely. Now, Lance, since you have spoken to so many farmers and ranchers, is there one problem that seems to be either voiced more than another or one that just really sort of threw you and you thought, wow, how are we going to overcome this?
Well, you know, I think that each farmer, each rancher, each forester is unique and they've got their unique set of challenges. But one of the things that many people don't really consider when thinking about how farmers and ranchers do their work is that nobody wants to be the generation that lost the farm, that lost the ranch. So trying new things that they are not familiar with, that perhaps their neighbors are not doing, is a really risky endeavor, because if they produce less, that means they also produce less income, which puts them in economic bind where they don't want to be the generation that lost the family farm or the family ranch. So there's this real fear of that occurring. So what I have found is a common theme is when they can talk to other people that are in those same situations that they are, and they've got somebody that has those same pressures that they do and they can learn from them, then they feel more confident in being able to try this new conservation practice or try this new water management practice that may take a year or two for them to see the benefits of, but they know, because they know an actual real life person that has gone through that, that it's worth it in the end.
Yes, absolutely. And thank you so much to your foundation for being the ground zero for all of this information. And the Leopold Conservation Award Program recognizes agricultural landowners actively committed to a land ethic. When you are looking to award this, which, by the way, I've heard is like the Nobel for agriculture, which is great, what key points are involved in the decision when you're talking about land ethic?
Sure. So there's criteria. It's not a, are you doing practice ABC or do you do this or do you do that? It's really about having that farmer, that rancher, that forester tell their story, say how they are making the very best of their situation. For somebody in arid conditions, they're facing different challenges and have to implement different practices than somebody that's experienced continual flooding, per se. So what we get down to is how they have manifested that land ethic. Are they looking at the land holistically as far as, hey, this non-productive area for crops might be a really productive area for pollinator habitat? Or if they are a grazer, how can I move the cattle across the land to mimic the bison for which the ecosystem developed so that that native flora and fauna can have the conditions into which they can flourish? And also, along with doing all of those really good things, it's how have they been able to utilize conservation to keep themselves resilient? Not only the land being resilient, but the actual farmer ranch family being resilient in that they can make enough money to be on the land the next year. So we want them to be able to show what they have done that benefits, whether it's soil health or water quality or wildlife habitat, but at the same time also has a neutral or positive impact on their bottom line.
Right. And do you have any particular story you could share about someone who went in one direction and then it just exploded in every direction regarding conservation and or sustainability?
Sure. I was just talking with this family the other day, and we have a family in Wisconsin that is primarily a grain farmer. They do other things as well, but they're a grain farmer. And with the recent weather patterns, they never seem to get rain at the right time or enough of it. So what they did was they dug out some of the low areas to create these almost settlement ponds, and then utilized irrigation equipment connected to the settlement ponds for when they need moisture. So it does a couple of things. When there's more rain than the crops or the ground needs, it runs into these ponds, which also collects any excess nutrients that would have run off into the watershed. And there's an area that it's contained. Then when they get to a dry area or a dry time of the year, they're able to utilize that water back onto the crop. So it provides wonderful water management resources. But one of the other things that's happened with that is they've created these little wildlife sanctuaries all throughout their property, where they've got ponds with drinking water for the wildlife. They leave a buffer around the ponds for birds and for mammals, and they don't go in there and mow them. So they've got these little sanctuaries throughout their farm. And at the same time, it's trapping any nutrients that would run off, and it's also providing that moisture when they need it. So it's kind of a fun little way that they're growing more, but they're also growing more wildlife in addition to grain.
Oh, that's so beautiful. Perfect. And Josh Hoy, also interviewed this month, was a 2020 winner, and he said he attended a conference in Steamboat Springs that was so inspiring. Is this an annual event? Is it open to the public? Tell us about that.
Sure. So it's not an annual event. We do it every 3 to 4 years, and we call it a symposium. And what we do is we invite all of the Leopold Conservation Award recipients and other interested parties to gather. And what we have found is that oftentimes these conservation superstars, I'll call them, are doing things a little bit differently. And oftentimes when they go to meetings, they are the odd person out. They're one of the tiny minority that is doing things quite a bit differently. So it's an opportunity for these like-minded farmers, ranchers, and foresters to find their peers and other people that are facing those very same conservation challenges and have found success at it, to find their tribe, if you will,
right,
where there's other folks that are facing the same challenges and they're not alone. It is a symposium that is largely led, as far as speakers and panelists and whatnot, by these farmers and ranchers, and they're sharing their stories and they're sharing their knowledge because collectively they want the agricultural community to do better. So it's an opportunity to gather and realize that you're not alone in seeking this conservation and land ethic path.
Sure. That's so great. And Lance, I loved hearing that you have a mentoring program. How does that work?
So this is something new and something we are so, so excited about. It's the Land Ethic Mentorship. And what we do is these Leopold Conservation Award recipients from around the country, if they would like to, they can become a mentor for a beginning or historically underserved farmer or rancher and serve as their conservation mentor to help them better understand everything from the why you would do a particular conservation practice to how do you get help through NRCS programs to implement that practice, whether it's cost share or just knowledge sharing. So what we've been able to do is pair these beginning and historically underserved farmers up with folks that have been through similar situations and come out the other side successful. We find that the Leopold Conservation Award recipients really want to share that knowledge. They want everyone to be successful. They want to shorten the learning curve for that next generation that is taking care of the land, so that collectively we have more conservation success throughout the country.
Yes, and that's certainly been the theme that's run through everything and everyone I've been talking to. It's the best type of community.
You know, farmers, ranchers, and foresters, the vast majority of them are very humble by nature, and they may not toot their own horn. They have been doing outstanding things for oftentimes decades, but people don't necessarily know that. If you know a farmer or rancher or forester that's doing great things and you think would be a fantastic example for the rest of your community, not only say thank you, but look for ways to provide them some recognition, whether it's the Leopold Conservation Award or whether it's another recognition program. It's important to let people know when they're doing well and that you appreciate what they're doing.
So, Ed, what was the bigger discovery for you, the third largest natural gas accumulation in the U.S., or that you were a radical conservationist?
You know, it might have been the latter, though it really came from the idea that I was watching the environmental movement criticize and demonize people like ranchers living on the land. And here I was, a geologist working in oil and gas. And I was also the enemy of the environment, which couldn't have been less true. At 10 years old, I went to the Adirondacks as a kid and fell in love with nature. And while I was doing geology, if you looked in my backpack, I could be out on a drilling rig and I would have my bird book, my Peterson. I would have my Audubon flower book. I'd have my book on Rocky Mountain trees. Every chance I got, I left the drill sites and I'd go hiking. And in my hikes, I would go up to private ranches and ask permission to cross their land. And they were really, really friendly. And so I got to really get interested in the lives of very large private landowners in the West.
You spent a decade in Africa working in the field with veterinarians and biologists to help the black rhinos survive. Was there a consciousness about land ethics? When you were working with the local people there, was there a consciousness about land ethics, or was it such a survival mode that really didn't come into the picture for them until perhaps they were prompted by outsiders coming in?
It depended upon what group you were talking about. Certainly in Zimbabwe, the old cattle ranchers, where cattle ranching was marginal, really couldn't make a living being a cattle rancher. And the laws allowed wildlife to be controlled by private landowners for economic purposes, for selling live animals, for eating the meat, for hunting, for photo safari. They already knew about Aldo Leopold's land ethic, and they were practicing it on the ground. The local communities, the native communities, the economics were not there for them. They had been excluded. They had been driven off of their communal lands when national parks were formed. They were angry and they were poaching wildlife. And so the principle became clear. If you could make the animals more valuable alive than dead to the local tribal people, they would help to protect the land. And part of the proof of that is that all our best trackers and rangers were ex-poachers.
Right. Very good point there, right? So that is a key point right there, of course. But what were some actual key steps to cultivating the partnerships between local communities and the landowners? What were some of the ABCs to doing that?
Well, Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, created a community program called CAMPFIRE. It's a long acronym, but basically it gives rights on communal lands to have a wildlife business. And if those communal lands were directly next to a national park, and this worked in South Africa, Zambia, and Zimbabwe, the animals were allowed to cross those boundaries without fences. And then the communal areas could also have safari lodges. It didn't have to be an exclusively upper-class white business. It could very well be a communal business for local people. And that CAMPFIRE program worked very well. The fellow that I ended up working with, Clive Stockhill, the chairman of the Save Valley Conservancy, your bloggers will not believe it. It's 960,000 acres. It's almost half the size of Yellowstone National Park. All wildlife land was privately owned by ranchers who are now ranching wildlife instead of ranching animals. And Clive was the spokesman for this and helped to translocate elephants, helped to open boundaries. We were partners with governments in the Peace Parks Initiative, which did not happen, which would have made 20 million acres of wildlife land open to animals and closed to humans from Zimbabwe to South Africa to Mozambique.
So was that a political deal that it didn't go through?
What I discovered in Africa is 20 years of the best conservation work could be destroyed by gangster governments who did not want to lose an election. That was Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe and his political party, ZANU-PF. They were a bunch of militarists who were armed by the Koreans, North Koreans, and Chinese. They won the war. They took control of a government. It looked like a democracy. They had an election in 2000. I was there at the time, and they stole it. And then they started attacking and beating up their own people and threatening whites who had legal rights to the land from that government with expulsion from the country.
One of my previous interviews, because I interviewed a rancher in Africa who had to move across country borders because he had his whole ranch stolen, all of his livestock, everything.
Well, in Zimbabwe, when they took the ranches and farms away from the whites, by the way, Zimbabwe was the fourth largest agricultural exporter in the world in 1998. And by 2005, it couldn't feed itself. And that's because they destroyed the ranching business. The politicians believed that they could make a deal with the whites and keep them on the farms. Hey, I own your farm now. You do all the farming and just give me 50% of the money every year. And the whites didn't tolerate that. They just left. They took up different businesses. They got off their ranches. And now there's nothing left but farm equipment. So these politicians sold the farm equipment.
Right.
It's amazing. It took 50 years to build up this industry in Zimbabwe, Rhodesia, and it took 6 months to destroy it.
Amazing. In working on conservation, literally around the world, Ed, do you see the real correlation being worked with as far as conservation and the regen ag movement and sustainability?
You know, I've been on the board of an extraordinary little American foundation called the Sand, S-A-N-D, County Foundation, named after Aldo Leopold's Sand County Almanac, published in 1949, that described in print, for the first time ever, the ethics of living on the land. It's a conservation environmental land ethic. And it was extraordinary for its time. It was philosophical, and it came from a forester, a professor of ecology, the first ever in the history of the U.S. And this movement is worldwide. It's recognized that most wildlife lives on private land. Living in the West, you get the idea that most wildlife lives on government land, and it is not true.
Right.
Not true. 80% of all important landscape is owned by private landowners. So you can threaten them, you can sue them, you can destroy their economics, you can kick them off the land, or you can incentivize them to be better stewards of the land.
Right. So when you were working in any of these places, do you see the gathering of the troops, so to speak?
Yes. People who are private landowners, farmers, ranchers, whether it's cattle or wildlife in Africa or in the U.S., they talk to their neighbors. They look over the fences for better practices. All you got to do is give them the opportunity and the ability to enlarge that scope of discussion to find where the best work is being done, and they'll do it themselves.
Right.
20 years ago, when I got into this, after I sold all my assets in oil and gas and became an active conservation advocate for private lands conservation, I discovered that there was lots of pushback. But there were very, very visionary people out there. For instance, Colorado Cattlemen's Association created the Colorado Cattlemen's Agricultural Land Trust. It is the oldest and most important land trust in Colorado. It holds conservation easements on, God knows, a million acres. And yet there was huge pushback from ranchers. They were afraid to do this. They didn't want to do it. And a middle-aged woman ranch wife, Lynn Sherrod, was the leader in this, and she was spectacularly successful. She just got out there and talked and talked and convinced very conservative ranchers to change the way they looked at conservation. They were doing it anyhow, but they were afraid of the environmental movement. They didn't want to be anybody's enemy. She made them the friends of the conservation movement.
Right.
And in Colorado, we have millions of acres under easement that will be protected from development that are important wildlife lands because of her. It's a wonderful experience being around Lynn Sherrod.
Oh, nice. That's great. Now, Ed, being in Africa with the rhinos, I'm sure you've got a million stories. Why don't you share one that will really give us the feel of what it was like to be there doing what you were doing?
Certainly. This was an interesting exercise. The way a rhino operation works is a group of crazy people, veterinarians, biologists, pitch up at a safari lodge. They might be in tents living on somebody's lawn, or they might be in a five-star safari lodge, and they have a spotter plane, the littlest plane around, a two-seat airplane with a pilot in the front and the spotter in the back. The back seat looks like a tin box, kind of like, well, maybe like a coffin, and a helicopter, one side of which the doors are removed so that the veterinarian can take his dart gun and fly up and shoot a dart in the back end of a rhino that's running. Ground crews in land cruisers, scouts on the ground, as many as three or four scouting parties of 7 to 8 or 9 people each, tracking rhinos, all tied together by shortwave radios. And so one day we were off on the Chiredzi Conservancy in Zimbabwe. That was about 500,000 acres. And we got word that there was a baby rhino that had been caught in snares. The snares are not meant for the rhinos. The snares are meant for small antelope. The people are poaching for meat, not for rhino horn in this case. But the baby rhino had run through some snares and she was badly injured. And we had to drive into this area like lunatics in trucks. And I got dumped out because the savannah was impenetrable. It was full of thorn bush and the vehicles couldn't get through. We could hear the helicopters. So I grabbed 2 veterinary packs. I weigh 140 pounds. The packs probably weighed 70 pounds. And I ran like a lunatic towards the helicopters because wherever they were, that's where the rhino was going to be. One of the helicopters, we had 2 that day, doubled back, spotted the vehicle, spotted me, gave me directions of how to get there. I ran 5 kilometers that day. We got to the baby rhino just as it was falling asleep from the sedative. You know, even a baby rhino can kill you. Sure. If they're still awake when you come upon them, they will charge you. And if you don't go up a tree, they gore you. So it's an instinctive animal. It's a dangerous animal. It's a loner. It's not a social animal. So they're very, very dangerous. So we worked on this baby rhino. We realized that it had to go to surgery. We had to remove it from its mother to try and save it. A snare had gone around its neck and cut its trachea. So we really had to do more than we could do in the field. And the sun had set. Helicopters are not allowed to fly in the dark. And one of the pilots came up to me, John, said, "Ed, you don't want to drive 5 hours to get back to camp, do you? Why don't you fly with me?" So let me translate that, Robin. What he was saying was, "Ed, I need a spotter to help me land back at the safari lodge because we're going to land in the pitch black. And the landing zone has 2 gas barrels next to it, and it's halfway under a tree. So I need somebody who's an idiot enough to hang out of the damn helicopter at the last moment and guide me into the landing zone." And that's what we did.
Well, you live to tell about it, and we're glad that you have.
So if your listeners don't understand me, my motto in life is better lucky than smart. Smart's really good, but sometimes lucky is a whole lot better.
Yes, absolutely. Now, Ed, what lesson stands out for you that you bring with you in all of your varied conservation efforts?
In almost every case, we can incentivize locals with money, with business opportunities around wildlife, with hunting businesses, with photo safari businesses. We can incentivize them. We can make animals more valuable alive than dead, but not rhinos. Because a bloody rhino horn is going in China for $65,000 a pound. There is no value that you can bring to that. So in the case of rhinos, we have to protect them. Most of the areas I worked, we had the scouts trained and the rangers trained by either the police or the army. And I raised the money in the US to buy them automatic weapons. Because the poachers are using AK-47s, the old Russian Kalashnikov, which is left over from the Cold War.
Wow. So,
and you can't have a scout armed with a shotgun come up against an automatic weapon. They have to be properly trained and armed. And so I'm now working on trying to get rhinos from South Africa on private lands into military lands in the U.S. where they can be protected by the U.S. military.
Wow, that's amazing. Where are things with that project?
I'm going back to Washington after my coral reef work in Mozambique in October. I'll be going to Washington in November. I'm on the board of the National Museum of Natural History, the Smithsonian, and I plan on meeting with people in Washington. I've got some working connections that can lead me to the upper echelons of the Pentagon. I firmly believe that you don't start at the bottom on something like this. You really got to get as close to the top as you can to get things started.
Sure. What are they using those rhino horns for? What are they using the rhino tusks for that they cost so much?
The demand for it comes out of old Chinese herbal medicine. It was a very rare thing. And so it was ground up and put in Chinese medicine as an aphrodisiac. Rhino horn has the same composition as your hair. So rhino horn is not even like an antler on an elk. It's actually just compacted hair. It was also used for the handles of very special knives in Arabia that were prized. And so those were carved. And we've gotten rid of that trade almost completely. The rhino horn trade in Asia is so big that my friends in the business of protecting rhinos tell me that 90% of the rhino horn used in Chinese medicine is actually water buffalo horn ground up. So where is the rhino horn going when it's worth $250,000 for a single horn? It's actually going into rich Chinese, into their glass shelves, right, as trophies, not being ground up for medicine. The trouble is that in the old days, there were no Chinese billionaires, and now there are a whole bunch of them. And they have excess money, and they're going to show off just like we do. Instead of buying a jet, you buy a rhino horn. I don't blame the Chinese necessarily, but we either have to make a commercial trade and take all that money off a rhino horn and put it into conservation, or absolutely control it, which has been very hard because it's too valuable. In Kruger National Park in South Africa, a few years back when I was there, there was a literal war going on. The army, not just the National Parks Rangers, were in there with guns fighting off the poachers that were coming in from Mozambique. These are poor people. $4,000 for $250,000 rhino horn could keep a family of poor Africans alive and fed for several years. So the economic pressure is enormous. I would tell your listeners this. If we're going to solve the problem of something like an illegal trade in ivory or rhino horn, it's going to have to happen in the elementary schools in China and Vietnam and places like, and India and places like that. We're not going to do it by shooting people. We're not going to do it by trying to trap these diplomats and businessmen moving back and forth between Africa and China or Vietnam. We need to change the mentality of how Asian kids look at nature. That's exactly what we did in the U.S. And I must say that preserving the African Pleistocene megafauna, isn't that a wonderful phrase? That comes from being a geologist and loving paleontology, loving mammoths and mastodons. The African Pleistocene megafauna is the only one left. We lost ours. We used to have mammoths and mastodons and woolly rhinos, and whether they were eaten by natives who crossed from Asia or they were killed by climate change during the ice ages, who cares? They're gone. This is the one that we need to protect and preserve for our future generations. When I realized that all the great oil and gas fields around the world are not found by the Exxons, they're found by the little guys like me who then are bought out.
Of course.
And made into rich people. And when I got the damn money, I didn't want to spend it on myself. I didn't believe that I should be flying around in a jet. I'm very directed in how I spend this fabulous gift that I got, this money that I got from oil and gas. And if it's all gone when I'm dead, that's a great thing. And in my belief system, I'm not going to be around after I'm dead to see what good work happens with my money. I got to do it while I'm alive. If we're not giving this money back, then we're not doing our jobs.
Somehow it all fits. Thank you, Josh Hoy, Lance Irving, and Ed Warner. I'm Robin Clare at cultivatedaudio.com. Thanks for being here and for making Here Where We Want to Be.